Our first class speaker in the second time slot is our brother Mark Vincent from the Boston, Massachusetts Ecclesia. And Brother Mark's theme for this week is suffering, man's problem, God's problem. And his class title for this morning is Outside and Inside. Brother Mark.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. So this talk has two titles. One is Inside and Outside. The other is I Don't Know. I don't think I've ever spoken about a subject where I'm so about which I'm so uncertain. But I've not come across anyone else who is more certain, or at least certain in an informed way. So we go forward trepidatiously, I think is the word. I'd be very interested to get your thoughts on what we'll be discussing, around the meal times or whatever, during the rest of this week. What we're going to be looking at in this session is the cause of particular examples of suffering and the extent to which we can put down suffering, examples of suffering as being caused by God or as being God's will that such and such a thing happens, and on the other hand, to what extent suffering is as a result of man's will and which man or, this is just the way things happen and that there are sort of natural causes to suffering. So there'll be a lot of uncertainty as we wrestle with that because it gets us into the issues of, predestination and free will and divine control and human responsibility. Those are things that people have grappled with those principles for thousands of years and sought to understand them, and we're still grappling with them today. Nevertheless, although there will be lots of things where we can't necessarily say for certain, we'll find out in later talks that actually it doesn't really matter, which is a relief. And also, we'll find that there are a couple of principles which are critical and about which we can be certain that will come out from today's talk, I hope. And that's what's sort of really important from today's session. So here's a slide with two columns on it. And down the left-hand side, we've got some points about human free will. But let's start on the right-hand side with some points about the extent to which God is in control in the world. God is all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-wise. All things are under his control, and the scriptures are full, and our lives have incidents where we feel that God has acted in a decisive way in our lives. He has intervened. The whole record of the Bible is about God's intervention into men's affairs. That intervention and involvement goes on, and it goes on to such an extent that God is even prepared to use people and nations as tools, to accomplish his purposes. We won't turn those references up, but let me just read to you Isaiah 10, verse 5. O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger and the staff in their hand is mine indignation. So God there is using the Assyrians as a tool, as his weapon, to punish his own people, the Israelites. And so the Assyrians there become less a people in their own right, and more as a thing that God uses. And yet that happens in such a way which is consistent with the Assyrians' own free will. And that's the wonder of how God works, isn't it? That their free will is not compromised, and yet God can still use them as a tool to further his purpose. And the other classic example is the example of Pharaoh. And Paul makes that point in Romans 9:17. Even for this cause have I raised thee up, to show my power in thee. And so again, Pharaoh there just becomes a kind of object that God will just use and ultimately break as he drowns him in the waters of the sea, to show how great God is, and that his purposes, rather than the purposes of Pharaoh, will prevail. Now, of course, Pharaoh is a particularly fascinating example, isn't he? Because we've got those examples of Pharaoh's heart being hardened. And what we have, and this is a sort of simplification and approximation for brevity, but roughly we've got a series of examples where Pharaoh hardens his own heart, and Pharaoh sets his course and chooses to be stubborn and to not let the people go. And that happens multiple occasions. And then in the second half of the plague narratives, we have another set of multiple occasions where God says, right, you've made your choice then. I'm not interested in you anymore, and now I'm just going to use you for my own purposes, to show my glory. And Pharaoh then just becomes a pawn, a tool, and it's God now who hardens Pharaoh's heart and pushes Pharaoh further down the path that he's already set for himself and says, okay, if that's the way you want to go, you go, and I'll use you to accomplish my purpose and to teach the world about what I am like. So God now hardens his heart. So we can see the two principles of God's intervention and man's free will working in action there in the example of Pharaoh. And I think that's a nice example of how the two things work together. Yes, Pharaoh is free to choose, but at a certain point, his course has been set and it's too late. And God now uses him as an implement for his own ends. So that's the right-hand side then about God being in control and God causing things to happen. So we can think then about God bringing examples of suffering into people's lives, potentially for specific purposes. It wouldn't be a surprise, given these points about his control and his purpose, that he might do that. And yet, at the same time, we have this principle of human free will. Free will is real and is everywhere taught implicitly. And we had it in this morning, didn't we, from Brother Jason's thought, where he reminded us from the verse in Joshua, where Joshua appealed, choose which gods you want to serve. And that verse means absolutely nothing if humans don't have free will. If we don't really have the power to choose, then that's just a meaningless, pointless verse, isn't it? It's all just a sham. So although it's true that, you know, there is no passage that explicitly says, and here is the doctrine of human free will, it's sort of on every page. It's everywhere implicit. God puts Adam in the garden, and he says to him, of every tree thou mayest freely eat, but of one tree thou shalt not eat of it. And so Adam has a choice of whether he eats or whether he does not. The famous passage in Deuteronomy 30, where Moses addresses the Israelites and says, I've set before thee this day life and good and death and evil. Choose which way you want to go. And Deuteronomy 28, where the blessings and the cursings are laid out, the implications of what they choose are set forth by God. So God has given us free will then, the Bible makes that clear. And if that free will is real, which obviously it is, then there are both good implications of that when we choose good things, and there are bad implications of it when we choose bad. It is possible to harm each other. And we've done it, haven't we? We've all done it. We've all harmed other people, whether it's emotionally or in whatever way. We have the power to harm ourselves also. If good choices are real, then bad choices must be real too. And so God's plan then to gather together people for himself who actually want to be with him, who want to have a relationship with him, involves a creation of a group of beings, human beings, who have a choice to do that, and who also must have a choice to do something else. And we do it. And therefore sin. And therefore suffering. And therefore the bondage of corruption that we talked about yesterday. So here's a principle then, which is absolutely central, isn't it? The free will principle. And, you know, theologians who write about suffering and the problem of evil, or theodicy as they often call it, they talk about the free will defense. And it's the argument that you can explain a lot of the suffering in the world on the basis of, if God is to allow human beings to be truly free, then the implications of that are that we can do bad as well as good. You know, no one wants to drive around in a car that's limited to only go at 25 miles per hour, do they? We want to have the freedom to do more than that. But of course, the implications are that when you drive faster than that, there's the potential that you can hit something and kill yourself. The freedom gives you the potential of pain and of harm. And God does that because he so values a relationship with those people who choose, rather than are forced, to serve him. So God puts limits on himself then, doesn't he? God, although God is all-powerful, he imposes constraints on himself to allow man to exercise his free will and for the implications of that to be seen. You remember how we talked yesterday about the punch and the pain? I mean, there's another way you can look at that, isn't there? You can look at it as I go to punch and maybe I don't feel any pain, but maybe my arm suddenly goes all floppy and just kind of drops to my side just as I'm about to make contact. That's another model, isn't it? That God could have set up the world so that we actually couldn't harm one another. But that wouldn't be free, would it? That would not be true freedom in any sense. And God has put these constraints on himself, and we do it all the time. You know, if we choose to have a game of chess, then we impose on ourselves the constraints of the rules of chess, don't we? I mean, you could just be halfway through your game of chess and just be so irritated that you say, well, I'm just going to move this pawn as if it were a queen. And, you know, just zoom all over the place with your pawn. And then, of course, it stops being a game of chess anymore, doesn't it? And it just becomes chaos. Or you could just sweep all the chess pieces aside with your hand because you're so exasperated that you're losing. And then, of course, you're not playing chess anymore. But if you want to have a game of chess, then you impose upon yourself the constraints of the rules of that game. And similarly, God has imposed constraints on himself in terms of, yes, he could intervene every time that someone was about to do something wrong, but that would not be a world in which people were truly free to make their choices. Here's a quote from C.S. Lewis. God might have arrested this process, the corruption of man's nature, by miracle, but this, to speak in somewhat irreverent metaphor, would have been to decline the problem which God had set himself when he created the world, the problem of expressing his goodness through the total drama of a world containing free agents, in spite of and by means of their rebellion against him. And that second part there, about God wanting to express his goodness in the world, I mean, there are plenty of animals who do everything instinctually, but we're different from that because we have this choice. And he expresses his goodness in this drama in which we are real actors with real choices, with real choices to make. We are the free agents. And in spite of, and even by means of our rebellion, God will accomplish his purpose. And that's one of the things that's so amazing about God, isn't it? That is, those are, in a sense, that is, in a sense, the game, if we can speak of it like that, that God has set himself. The project, that would be a better word, wouldn't it? The salvation of human beings with free choice. And so when we think about this, what are the implications of men's free will? They're immense, aren't they? How much human suffering is due to free will, to our choices? And we think of all war and all crime and all guilt and the suffering that can bring, and all hurt because relationships have gone wrong or because there's been misunderstandings. All pollution and the problems that has caused. All those things, all accidents that are down to operator error on the part of human beings. All those things, all that suffering and all that pain All the abuse of all types that takes place in our world, big and small, all that is down to us. So, you know, when that guy wrote his book and called it God's Problem, How the Bible Fails to Address Human Suffering, the Bible addresses human suffering right away in chapter 3 as soon as man had spoilt it and explains the implications of it, doesn't it? It's not God's problem in that sense, it's man's problem. And that's the free will principle. That free will brings, of necessity, because of the choices that we make, it brings suffering. So, but an interesting point emerges out of this. You know, we ask, well, how much of all those that we've just listed, massive categories of suffering, haven't we? You know, even some things that might be called natural disasters, you know, depending on what you think about climate change, even some of that might be down to human behavior too, mightn't it? What percentage of the suffering in the world is down to human beings, to human free will? Well, we don't know, do we? We would be guessing, finger in the air type thing. C.S. Lewis reckoned it was maybe 4/5 of human suffering. I don't have any particular reason to think that it's higher or lower than that. But it's a huge amount, isn't it? A massive amount of human suffering. There is enough food in this world to feed everybody. You remember all those children dying of hunger that we quoted yesterday? There's enough food there to do. We are capable of solving that problem, theoretically speaking, but the world in which we live does not have the political will to solve it. And although we could share it all around, we don't. And so that suffering persists. Every minute, more children die. And that's because of human beings and the suffering that we cause. So now if we... Let's just assume for the sake of argument that 4/5 is right, that it's more than 50% anyway. That massive amount of suffering that's in the world is human derived. And if we also say, well, actually things like disease and our own mortality, they're human derived as well in a way because of what we were talking about yesterday, because of the curse that God, the punishments that God placed upon us. That teaches an interesting point about how much God values our love and our free will worship, that free sacrifice that we make when we care about God and try to please Him. Because do you know what? God has to sit and watch all that pain and suffering that comes as a result of our free will. That is the price of Him having a relationship, ultimately, in the kingdom, with those people who want to be with Him. That's the cost of it. That is an enormous cost. And the fact that that cost is so high tells us how precious it is when we actually come before Him in prayer, when we worship Him, because we choose to do so, because we want to, and because He is worth it. The value to Him is so great that He's prepared to tolerate the world and to watch all that pain and anguish. That's how much it matters to Him. That's how much we matter to Him, which is quite a transformational way of thinking about it, I think. So there's the free will principle, then, which is critical to understanding approaching an understanding of the problem of suffering. But I'd like to go now to think more again about God's involvement in causing circumstances and situations, the extent in which God is involved in human suffering. So we saw yesterday that God put death as a punishment for sin into the world, and we saw the implications of that bondage of corruption. And that God stands back and lets our free will and its implications unfold in the world. And God is also actively involved specifically in punishing nations. He's actively involved in the death of Pharaoh and the Egyptian hosts. He was actively involved in punishing His people by bringing the Assyrians, the rod of His anger, against them. So God does that too. God causes suffering to punish people, which is tomorrow's subject. And there's also collateral damage as God unfolds his purposes. So think of all the children and the wives of those soldiers who were drowned in the Red Sea. That's collateral damage, isn't it, for God's punishment upon the Egyptians. All the babies and small children who died in the flood. That's collateral damage, again, because of the new beginning that God is forced to make upon the earth. So God is involved then in those examples of suffering in all those different ways. Let's have a look at or think about some passages then. And, you know, when we think about to what extent is God the cause or to what extent do things just sort of unfold naturally, so there are two extremes here, and there are some people who believe that God is the cause of, you know, pretty much everything. The trouble is, if you go right to that extreme, then you start to diminish free will, and you start to make the world more as if it's a kind of maze, and God is just pushing us around the maze, you know, by making this happen, and this happen, and this happen, and this happen, and so that we're forced to go a particular way. And again, you start to diminish free will by that, and start to make us more like robots and less like the free agents, which the Bible tells us we are. So, you know, there's danger in going too far to that extreme, and there's a danger in going too far to the other extreme and saying, well, you know, the world just kind of happens automatically, and we're responsible for everything, because the Bible clearly tells us that God is involved very actively. Now, the question comes, well, where do we, in that spectrum then, where is the right point to be? And that's why I say this talk is also called I Don't Know, because that isn't precisely specified, is it, on that spectrum? I think we can say that both extremes here are wrong, but brethren and sisters will differ in quite how they think about where we draw the line. Here are some passages which take us more towards the God's active involvement. But I think none of them demand this kind of understanding where, you know, everything that happens in our lives is God's will. You know, so do we have to say that, you know, if I catch a cold, that's God's will, or that God caused that to happen? Do we have to say that, or is that just the sort of natural unfolding? I went into the room where there was someone with a contagious disease, and I got too near them, and that's just, my antibodies were in such and such a state, and that just happened. Well, and just to sort of illustrate how this is tricky, I think probably most of us might say, well, that's just something that naturally happened. But then if you talk about a more serious disease, you know, suppose I suddenly now contract a very serious disease and my days are going to be very short from this point on, we'd be more likely to say that is God's will, and that God brought that into my life. But do we have any real basis for distinguishing between the two? And this is, you know, this is the difficulty that we're involved in considering this subject. Let me give you another example. You might be almost in a very serious car crash, or you might be in a serious car crash and something happens so that you're not injured at all. And we might see the hand of God at work in the stopping of that car crash. But then we might ask, what caused the events that led up to that car crash? Do you see the issue? So what are we saying there? Are we saying that things unfold naturally, sort of by themselves, up to a certain point, and then God can choose to intervene, the hand of God stops the car crash, or the hand of God chooses not to intervene, and the car crash occurs, or the injury, or the death occurs? And of course, there have been both examples in our community, haven't there? There have been people in our community who have died in car crashes, and there have been people in our community who, by all natural laws that we might think of, you might have expected something very serious to happen, and it didn't. And we might see the hand of God at work in that. But in all of those circumstances, at the end of the day, we don't really know for certain, do we, unless God tells us. But what we do know is that God is watching and that God is able to intervene. And we also know that the choices that we make are significant and do matter. So here are some verses. I create peace and I create evil. But you can understand that in quite a specific sense, or you can understand it in a much more general sense, that God brings trouble into the world in some of the ways that we were talking about yesterday. Shall there be evil in the city and the Lord has not done it? Some people would quote that as saying, well, you know, all things that occur in cities, therefore, are the result of the hand of God. But again, that it's quite possible that that's overinterpreting what Amos is saying there. He's talking about God's actions to judge his people Israel. And we know that his people Israel were under Deuteronomy 28. And if they displeased him, he would punish them physically here and now. And they had displeased him. And so God says, if there be evil in the city, shall there be evil in the city and the Lord has not done it? The reason why you're suffering, Israel, is because God is punishing you because you've disobeyed him. So it would be possible to take Amos 3 and generalize that into a position which is over here, of God is causing, you know, a great amount of things. Or it would be possible to read the passage in a quite different way, as I've just explained. He makes the blind and the deaf. And that's true. He makes all of us. Again, to what extent is the passage saying that this is a result of natural genetic processes, or that it was God's specific will that this child wouldn't have been blind, and then God said, no, I want this child to be blind. How do we understand that? And so we could go on through some of those other passages. The one about the potter is interesting because, of course, when the potter makes something on a wheel, he is continuously involved, isn't he? His hands are there, or her hands are there, shaping the pot. So that's interesting. But again, God can shape things in, you know, through all the circumstances of life. So how much does that verse really imply about whether God is micromanaging? Let's say, you know, if we put it in management, modern management terms, that God is micromanaging every decision and little event that happens in life, or that he's standing rather further back, but at particular decisive points and in response to prayer, he will intervene according to his will. I'd like us to look at a couple of passages in Daniel, because Daniel is quite interesting on this subject. Daniel 2 and verse 21. God changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives knowledge unto the wisdom to the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. He revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and the light dwelleth with him. So there's a good passage about God's involvement at the political level in terms of rulers. The powers that be, says Paul in Romans 13, verse 1, the powers that be are ordained of God. God is actively involved in our world, and the rulers that are in place are there because that is according to God's will, or because he is prepared to accept that within the constraints of his unfolding purpose at a particular time. Or chapter 4, Daniel 4, when Nebuchadnezzar is humbled, at the end of verse 25, this was what Nebuchadnezzar had to learn right at the end of the verse. Till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and giveth it to whomsoever he will. Or at the end of verse 26, after that thou shalt have known that the heavens do rule. And verse 35, and all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou? So there's some great verses about that give us assurance that God is in control of our world, and that it's not the case that we're right down here and things are just unfolding and who knows what will happen. God is in control. And although he has given us free will, he is still in control, and he can intervene and act decisively at any moment. And nothing will happen to us which is outside of his control. God knows when the sparrows fall. Even the hairs of our head are numbered. So everything that happens then, God is able to intervene and act, whatever it might be. He is in ultimate and absolute control. But nevertheless, he is working out his purpose according to the constraints of free will. And although he has a goal in sight, some people think of this in terms of, God knows the end from the beginning. He has the end goal in sight, but there may be different routes to get to that end goal according to man's free will. And so as man and men make their choices, God will make adjustments to bring the world towards his purpose. And again, that's a sort of a human analogy rather than a scriptural analogy. But there are scriptural passages that talk about God making adjustments to his purpose that might support that kind of way of understanding things. Just while we're in Daniel, let's remind ourselves quickly about the Prince of Persia in Daniel 10. Daniel 10 and verse 12, "Then said the angel unto me, Fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that thou didst set thine heart to understand and to chasten thyself before thy God, thy words were heard, and I am come for thy words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. But lo, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, and I remained there with the kings of Persia." So the angel wanted to be there to help Daniel straight away, but something happened in the world that meant that he couldn't be there as soon as he'd intended to be. And this prince of Persia, whether that was an angel working out God's purposes in Persia, or whether that was literally the rulers of Persia, were doing things that meant that the angel had to be involved working out God's plan so that he couldn't get to Daniel right away. But in the end, he made it. I think we don't quite understand what that passage means, but we can sort of get the idea, can't we, of what I've just explained. God has a purpose and he will accomplish it. Sometimes the actions of men and things that are unfolding will cause delays or issues, but God can work with those issues because he is in control. The angels can work with them. And so God's purposes will be carried out, and we can be assured of that fact. I'm going to have to skip a lot here because all that took me a lot longer than it was meant to. Let's just remind ourselves of 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 12. 'For the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous, and his ears are open unto their prayers. But the face of the Lord is against him that is evil.'" So God's eyes are open. He sees everything that we undergo. He cares, as we saw with the sparrows and the hairs of our head. And he is able and will intervene in our lives and ensure that his will for us is done. So we come to the reconciliation of these two things then, God's involvement and man's involvement, and this is a term that's sometimes used of compatibilism. We have to understand both of these aspects, and we have to make sure that we don't overstress one, whichever one it is, at the expense of the other. Otherwise, we get a wrong understanding of God and his purpose. God is absolutely sovereign, but his sovereignty never functions in such a way that human responsibility is curtailed, minimized, or mitigated. On the other hand, human beings are morally responsible creatures. They significantly choose, rebel, obey, believe, defy, make decisions, and so forth. but they are rightly, and they are rightly held accountable for such actions. But this characteristic never functions so as to make God absolutely contingent. You know, God is not dependent. It's not in doubt whether God will achieve his purpose with the kingdom or not, depending on what we do. He will achieve it. We may believe, and so some people do, that it's in doubt when it will be, depending on what our actions are. That's a view that some people take. But the fact that it will happen is not in doubt. So he's not totally contingent upon us, because he can intervene at any point and cause anything to happen that he wills, because he's God, and that's what being God means. And another way of putting that is to say that human actions are penultimate. They're significant, but they're not ultimate. God is ultimate. His actions are ultimate. So, we were going to look at Ecclesiastes and talk about time and chance, but we don't have time to do that. We were going to look at Romans 8:28, all things work together for good to them that love God. That's interesting, because the things that he talks about in the surrounding passages are not pleasant things. They're persecutions and afflictions and so forth. And in those things, God will work for good for his people. So we may not know what the cause of a particular piece of suffering is. Let me give you another example. There was a brother in our ecclesia in Scotland, in the Stirling Ecclesia, Brother David Mould, and about 45 years ago, his wife went out picking blackberries one day while the children were at school, and she was murdered in the woods behind her home. And of course, the children come home from school, and he comes home, and of course, their life is never the same. And what can we say about the cause of that? Can we say that that was God's will? Can we say that that was something that naturally happened? Can we say that there's a human cause behind that, because an evil man did an evil deed? And we could certainly say that, the wrong place at the wrong time. But ultimately, there's a limit to what we can say about it, except one thing we can say. We can say that God accomplishes his purposes in the world despite what happens, in spite of human choices and human evil. And in fact, God's specialty in the world is to bring good out of human evil. And this is our last and essential principle. So we had the free will principle, which was critical, wasn't it? The free will principle explained the vast majority of suffering in our world. And here's the other principle for today, which is critical. God is expert at utilizing human sin for his ends. And in that example that I quoted, the brother later met someone that he worked with and brought her into the truth. And so that was a good that God brought out of something that was evil. You don't have to say that the actual act of the murder was a good thing. You don't even have to say, some people might want to say that that was God's will. I don't think you necessarily have to say that that was God's will. It was something that happened according to the evil of man. But out of that evil, God brought good. And by God's grace, that sister will be in the kingdom. And the other sister too. God does this all the time. The Bible is full of examples of God bringing good out of evil. Think of the crucifixion. The things that wicked men took him and have crucified him and slain him. What greater evil could there be that men should take the Son of Man and kill him? And yet God brings out of that evil the greatest good that could ever have been done for human beings. And at the very moment of his death, that most evil moment, God brought conversion for that man, that Roman soldier who said, truly, this was the Son of God. Now that is good out of evil, isn't it? In the instant, at the moment that it happens. Think of the Holocaust, the despicable thing that was done. And yet, Out of that evil, God brings good in the return of his people to their land. We've talked about the example of that murder. Think of how the gospel was spread in the Acts of the Apostles. It was spread by persecution, wasn't it? The persecution that took place around the Jerusalem area caused people to leave and to go into other cities to preach. And then the persecution spread there, so they went further and preached more. And the gospel spread like wildfire through the Roman Empire. And God brought good out of evil once again. And out of the evil of the Jews' rejection of their own Messiah, God brought the good of the gospel message going to the Gentiles. And out of sickness and disease and all other types of suffering, God can bring good in the development of human character and personality. That will be something that we'll look at in the coming talks. So it doesn't matter at the end of the day. We'll come tomorrow to talk about how it doesn't matter whether we understand the causes or not when we look at Job. The day after tomorrow. But it's not our responsibility to explain why any particular example of suffering occurred. What we need to know is that God can bring good out of it. What good will come out of it depends on the choices that we make and how we react to it, doesn't it? That's the good that will come. We are in control of what good comes depending on how we react. Isn't that an amazing thing? God's now leveraging our free will in our response to bring more good out of evil. Let's finish by looking at these references from Genesis, because these are the very essence of God's ability to bring good from evil. And of course, they're from Joseph in the land of Egypt. Genesis 45. And verse 5. And this is where Joseph weeps and makes himself known to his brethren. I am Joseph. Doth my father yet live? Verse 3. And his brethren could not answer him, for they were troubled at his presence. Verse 5. Now therefore be not grieved, my brothers, nor angry with yourselves that ye sold me hither, for God did send me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years hath the famine been in the land, and yet there are 5 years in the which there shall be neither eating nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. Here's good out of evil, isn't it? Life saved in an evil thing and brought to a great deliverance. So now it was not you that sent me hither, but God. And he hath made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and a ruler throughout the land of Egypt. What an amazing thing that Joseph, the guy from prison, should be made the father of Pharaoh and the ruler of Egypt. And if we were to look in chapter 50, we would say the same thing. The God who we serve is a God who can bring bring good and blessing out of the evil of man.